Okay, so this is Bio 231. It is February 4th, and it's a Wednesday. We're going to proceed with bones today. But don't forget, on Monday, you have your first test in here. So you got to make sure you got your Scantron, a pencil, and what's the most important thing? Oh, yeah, I forgot your picture ID. Don't you forget your picture ID, but that's okay. We would just put you on a special list. Well, what's the most important thing? A good eraser, in case you want to change an answer that you put down on your Scantron. You can't smudge up your Scantron, because the Scantron reader will just mark it as incorrect, and you'll get gypped out of points. And I don't want anybody to get gypped out of points in here. Okay? All right, so here's the latest on SI. Maybe I'll stop in also Monday for a little bit during SI if you have some last-minute questions. And if you want those SI notes, you have to go to the SI session, right? Otherwise, just because of budget constraints, we can't provide them for everybody. So don't get mad at me. Certainly never get mad at your SI leader, right? Because it's her boss telling her that, or telling him that. Since I'm recording, I shouldn't give away any secrets. So please try to attend if you want those notes. So to me, that tells me that a lot of people value those notes, and you would probably value the SI session as well. All right. How many people went to open lab on Friday, last Friday? Raise your hand. Ooh, a lot of people. That's nice. It was a little bit crowded. I know, since I'm recording again, I don't want to say her name. But anyway, thank you for this lab instructor showing up, volunteering to open up open lab. She's going to be there for 2 hours, but actually was there for 3 hours. So that was nice. And my guess is if we're really nice to this teacher, that she might volunteer to do it again sometime in the future. So raise your hand if you thought that was helpful to you. Raise your hand if it was helpful. Okay, so kind of look around the room and see. So in that regard, I'm going to pass around this thank you card. And if you were there and you want to say thank you, I'll give it to her, okay? And if you don't want to, just give me the card back and I'll use it some other time. Okay, I forgot my mouse today, so I can't be lecturing from over here. I got to stand in front of the podium over there. So I did mention a test next time, right? Okay, so let me just see what's on the test. Make sure everybody's on the same page. February 9th. Chapters 1, 2, 4, and 5. We're skipping chapter 3. All right, 1, 2, 4, and 5. And everybody's got your study materials and know the format of the test. You need an 882, that excellent eraser. Make sure you know your exam figures, because there will be some exam figures on the test. And you just get 100% on that part of the test. For most people, that's the easiest part. How many questions? Between 50 and 100. Okay, so maybe this first test, I won't go up to 100 questions. Maybe I'll have a little bit less than that, but you need two clean sides on the Scantron. Okay, yeah. So probably over 50 questions. The more, the better. In case you make a silly mistake on one question, that doesn't hurt you as much. If there's only one question on the test, and you make a silly mistake and you miss it, what do you get? A zero. That's really hard to recover from a zero, but if there's 100 questions on the test and you make one silly mistake, you get a 99%, right? So the more questions, the better, actually. So we try to tune up the test length a little bit to help you guys out. Okay. All right, so last time we were talking about bones, like the parts of a long bone. So I'm not going to show you a picture. But what are some, put a picture in your mind, what does a long bone look like? Okay. Okay, it just means that it's the dimensions, right? Think of three dimensions. One dimension is big, and the other two dimensions are small. So there's one dimension that's long, and the other two dimensions are really, really small. All right, and you have some long bones in your digits. You have three long bones, for instance, in your little pinky finger right here. And they sure don't look very long, but nonetheless, one dimension is big and the other two dimensions are small. That's still a long bone, right? So That's what you should appreciate about long bones. And then, what are the ends of a long bone called? And why the heck what might we be interested in what we call the ends of a long bone? What do the ends of a long bone do for us? Yeah, it has cartilage over it because they form joints, right? The ends of long bones form joints, and that allows us motion and movement and communication and all kinds of things like that. So the ends of long bones are very important for that reason, because of joints. So what do we call the end of a long bone? That's the diaphysis. Yeah, what's the middle or the shaft of a long bone called? That is the diaphysis, right? So the epiphyses are the ends. The diaphysis is the middle part. And here's a sign-in sheet. If you don't sign in, I've had a lot of students come and ask me, oh, you know, I was here, but I didn't sign in. Can I sign now, a day later? But you know, you can't. Now is the time to sign that sign-in sheet. All right, so please don't try to tell me you were in class if you don't sign the sign-in sheet, because I'm not holding your hand down, stopping you from signing, okay? Everybody is free to sign the sign-in sheet. That's your responsibility to sign it, please. Okay. All right, so what's deep inside of a long bone? The medullary cavity. And what's inside that medullary cavity? Is it just air? No, there's marrow. And then furthermore, you should know there's a couple different kinds of marrow, like red marrow and bone marrow. What's red marrow good for? It's a hemopoietic tissue. It makes red blood cells. And what good is a yellow bone marrow? Yeah, it's adipose tissue, which stores energy for us. So bones can store energy. Bones also store some other things that we're going to talk about today, namely calcium and phosphate, which makes up the bone matrix. So again, don't forget, what kind of tissue is bone? It's connective tissue, right? So connective tissue is characterized by having cells, an extensive matrix, and the matrix is really what defines the characteristics of a connective tissue. It's the matrix. In this case, it's going to be what? Hard. But we'll look at some other components as well. Okay. So I got a lecture from here today because I forgot my mouse. So you guys in the front row here are going to get blasted. Hopefully you have some cotton for your ears because I have to talk really loud. All right, so we talked about the periosteum and the endosteum. Where do you find the periosteum? Around the outside of a bone, and the endosteum lines all of the cavities inside the bone, like medullary cavity and the trabecular cavities. And don't forget, cortical bone is, where do you find cortical bone? Yeah, it is compact. That's another name for cortical bone. But in terms of location, where do you find cortical bone? Okay. Cortical as opposed to medullary. The cortex is what part of an organ? Any organ, bone or whatever. The cortex is the superficial part. Oh yeah, that would be interesting. It would be probably make some sense if cortex meant core, but it doesn't really mean core. Okay, it means the superficial surface. It's the outside part of the organ. And the medulla is the deep part. Right, the medulla of any gland is the deep part. So cortical bone, where do you find cortical bone then? On the outside, that's the superficial part of bone. And furthermore, it is compact bone. So sometimes we use those terms interchangeably. All right, but cortical just really means superficial, and typically all superficial bone or cortical bone is compact bone. All right, so I think that's where we stopped last time. Okay, so here is, wait a second, do I have another picture? Oh, here is even a better picture. All right, so let's go back to the illustration. And the structural and functional unit, so write that down, structural and functional unit. Let's see, I think we talked about that before. What's the structural and functional unit of life?
Cell.
It's a cell, right? So it's nice to know building blocks or to be able to break complex things down into building blocks to get an appreciation for that complex thing. And bone is pretty complex. And so I want you to know the structural and functional unit of compact bone or cortical bone, and that is the osteon. So here is an osteon right here. So you can see that it has many layers. And what's the shape of these layers of an osteon? They're in one dimension, they look like circles, like tree rings, but think in three dimensions. What are they really? They're like this thing right here. They're a tube, a very, very strong kind of structure. Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit about forces and tubes. This tube, if we hit it from the side pretty hard, it's going to bend. All right, but if we just put weight right on top of it like that, it's going to be extremely strong. We call that compression. It's almost impossible to compress a tube just by its architecture. And you can see in bone, right, or at least compact bone, what's the structure? It is a tube, right, within a tube, and you got what, inside more tubes, and they're next to tubes within tubes within tubes, and all these tubes that are within tubes, what are they surrounded by? Another tube. So bones are almost impossible to compress. They're very strong just because of their architecture. Okay. But that's not the only thing. Let's look inside this osteon right here. So these tubes or these layers are what we call lamellae. And there's the lamellae that go on the outside, that go all the way around the bone. Those are the circumferential lamellae. Okay. And the osteon right here. Let's look at an osteon. We'll take a little slice through an osteon. And don't forget, bone is a living tissue. What was your first guess that bone is a living tissue if you were to look at this slide right here? You have a lot of blood vessels feeding bone, right? So it's a highly metabolic organ. And as a matter of fact, let's look at that column right there. Ooh, the people sitting next to that column that's holding up the building right there. And there's some over here. If you were going to design this building to be even stronger, what would you do to that column?
Make a hole in the middle?
Make a hole in the middle? I don't know. It might crack then. But look at the shape of that column right there. It's rectangular. I'd be nervous sitting there. You know what I would like to see? I would like to see, yeah, archway would be really strong, but I'd like to see a nice column that is what? Tubular in nature. It would be 10 times as strong as that one right there. Right? So don't forget, tubes are really, really strong. I don't think the building's going to fall down. But anyway, they probably could have saved a lot of material if they just made it tubular. Okay, but anyway, so that's concrete. Now, is that concrete the same concrete that was there 10 years ago? Yeah. So that's not a good way to think of a bone, because your bones get remodeled every 5 years. 5 years ago, you didn't have any of the bones that you have today. They're always being broken down and rebuilt in the correct location and position to adjust for your lifestyle. So if you start exercising, guess what happens to your bones? They get bigger and stronger, and they remodel themselves to support that kind of stress. Just like if you were to start lifting a weight, right, and do curls all day long, what would happen to your biceps brachii? Okay, it would get bigger and stronger, right? It would get bigger and stronger to handle that additional stress. And your bones respond the same way as well. Okay, so your bones are only good for about 5 years, and they're always being replaced. So that means that there have to be living cells inside bones just to do that kind of job. And in the tissues chapter, you learn the name of bone, or the name of cells in mature bone. What's the name of the cells in mature bone called? What are they called? Osteocytes, and you can see one here. And you can see where they're located. These little dark spots in the osteon, these are called, these are lacunae, right? They're lacunae. So here's a little lacunae, which is a pit in the bone. That's a normal pit. And that houses an osteocyte that maintains the health of the bone in this little neighborhood right here. It keeps the bone healthy. All right? But in order for cells to stay alive, what do they need? They need blood, because blood is bringing oxygen. All right, so cells need oxygen. The mitochondria in here need oxygen to make ATP. They need nutrients like glucose. They need ions like calcium and sodium and chloride. All right, so these cells need materials so that they can be alive and maintain the health of the bone. So how does material get from blood to this cell right here if the cell is surrounded by bone? Because what is bone? It's a solid structure. All right, let's say I was in that room back over there, and you guys were holding a party over here, and I wanted a margarita. right? And I was stuck in this room, and I could yell, hey, give me a margarita, and what, could you hand me a margarita through this wall? No, I'd be out of luck, right? You need a passageway to hand something off. So the way that nutrients, including fluids and oxygen, get to these cells are through these little passageways in bone. Those are called canaliculi. That's the passageway for things to diffuse from one cell to another, or from the cells to the blood, or vice versa, so that the cells can stay alive. Okay, so canaliculi. And they don't really make the bone less strong. So this is the osteon, one of the parts of the osteon system. Okay, you got the osteocytes, the canaliculi, the lacunae, and I haven't mentioned this before, but there are blood vessels that go through the central canal of the osteon right here. So this is just the central blood vessel, but there are others that go from side to side of a long bone, and we call those perforating or Volkmann's canals as well. All right, so there is a blood supply throughout the whole bone, everywhere in bone, as a result of that. So this is the picture that you're used to seeing from the histology part of the class, and you can see the concentric lamellae around an osteon, and you can see the blood vessel right here in the central canal. Sometimes we call that the Haversian canal. Here's a lacuna, and inside that lacuna is an osteocyte that's responsible for maintaining the bone matrix, and you can even see some of these little canaliculi in this slide as well. Okay, I don't know if I'll mention this on a test or anything, but there are even parts of bone that fill in the spaces between osteons, because the osteons are tubular, so here's an irregular space. We just call that an interstitial lamellae, but you can see again that it's made up of different plates. All right, so be familiar with that. All right. Now, bone. Let's break bone down into some different parts. There's two main parts to compact bone. There's an organic part and an inorganic part. So there's the two main parts, and I tell you what, maybe I've never told anybody this in here, but maybe you should know what the difference is between an organic compound and an inorganic compound before I tell you how we can break bone up. An organic compound has got to have an element of carbon. C stands for carbon. And it's got to have something else. It's got to have another element bound to it. It's got to have a hydrogen bound to it, just like that. So any kind of molecule that has a carbon atom and a hydrogen, if they're bound together, that's organic. Inorganic doesn't have those two compounds together. So I'll give you a real quick quiz right now. What about H2O? Is that an organic or inorganic compound? Inorganic, because it's got hydrogen, plenty of hydrogens, but no carbon. What about CO2? Is that organic or inorganic? Okay, tricky question. Because there's a C, but no H. So it is inorganic. All right, so is water important biologically for us? Absolutely, right? We can't dehydrate. What about CO2? Is that an important biological compound? Yeah, because we breathe that out of our bodies all the time. So just because something's organic doesn't mean it's a biological molecule, right? As a matter of fact, there's plenty of organic compounds that are very deadly to living systems, right? But an organic compound is going to have this carbon and a hydrogen. Like, for instance, this is a sugar molecule. So here's what a sugar molecule looks like, or at least a part of one. All right, like that. And is that an organic compound? Because here's a C, and here's a C, and there's an H. So sugars are organic compounds, and they're important biological compounds as well. Okay, so the organic components, they're cells, okay, because cells have organic molecules making them up. There are three kinds of cells that you should be familiar with. There's something called an osteocyte right here. Where do we find an osteocyte? In lacunae. They're what is found in mature bone cells, or mature bone tissue, are osteocytes. All right, then there is a cell called an osteoblast. How do you know that's involved with bone? Because you have the osteo in there. An osteoblast is a cell that builds bone. It builds bone up. So it's kind of handy that there's a B in blast and there's a B in build that builds bone. And then the last kind of cell right here is an osteoclast. And an osteoclast breaks bone down. Okay, so these two are in balance all the time, an osteoblast and an osteoclast. If you have cells that are breaking bone down, namely osteoclasts, in order to stay the same size, you need to have what other kind of cells working? Osteoblasts, right? So that they balance out. And that's very important to have, find balance in somebody's body. Yeah. The blast?
Yeah.
The blast builds bone.
Okay. What is the one that destroys bone?
The one that destroys bone is clast. That's okay. Osteoprogenitor cell. Well, there are cells. Let me tell you about the osteoclast. I got a picture. I'll show you what an osteoclast is. An osteoclast is a huge cell. And it has many nuclei in it, and it's a big, huge cell because it's the result of maybe 100 smaller, regular-sized cells fusing together to form an osteoclast. So the cells that come together to make an osteoclast are what we call the progenitor cells. They don't have a lot of activity until they fuse together to make an osteoclast. All right, so I have that in my notes someplace. That's nice. Okay, I don't remember putting it in there. All right, so let me see if I can find an osteo. So here is an osteoclast, and you can see a lot of nuclei inside this cell, and it has these little processes that are poking down into the bone, and the bone at one time was what? A nice flat surface? But what is this osteoclast doing? It's actually dissolving away. A pit in the bone is dissolving the bone matrix as a result. And in that matrix, you have calcium. That calcium then gets put in the blood, and it's very important to have good calcium levels in the blood. But the osteoclast activity is also what makes what? This trabecular bone. It hollows out the deeper parts of bone or medullary bone so that it becomes spongy, so that it can contain bone marrow, so that it's lighter, so that it's not so hard to carry your skeleton around. All right, and then, your body wants to have a nice strong bone here, here's an osteoblast, and what does the osteoblast do? Then it fills in this little pit that is created by the osteoclast, and then here you see some new bone matrix. So this is happening all the time on your bones. Okay. Another organic component, and that is collagen. Collagen, does anybody know what vitamin is necessary to have in your diet in order to make collagen? Okay, good guess. I tell you what, let's go back one step further. Do you think it's important to be able to make collagen in your body? What's collagen used for? What kind of tissue, especially? Dense, regular connective tissue, right? It's pretty much in all connective tissues, but dense, regular, dense, irregular, right? So what does dense, regular connective tissue make?
Tendons
and ligaments that hold your body together. Dense, irregular makes up the dermis, the deep part of your skin, right? The reticular layer of your skin. And so if you can't make collagen, right, your skin is going to be really weak, your tendons and ligaments are going to be really weak, but if you damage a part of your body, it won't ever heal. Right, so if you get a tendinous injury or a ligamentous injury, it will never heal if you can't make collagen. So there's a vitamin that's necessary to build collagen, which helps you recover whenever you sprain an ankle or you hurt a joint or you pull a muscle or something. Did anybody ever sprain an ankle in here? Oh, that's good. I'm glad. Anybody ever, I'm the only one that's sprained an ankle 20 times? So everybody, okay, a lot of people sprain an ankle, all right? Kind of painful. You get over it in about a year if you have therapy, right? Okay. But when you went to see a doctor, did they ever tell you you should take one of these vitamins so that you can make collagen very easily? They did? That's excellent. And that's vitamin C. Vitamin C is necessary to make collagen. And one last question I'll ask you for fun. Is vitamin C dangerous? Can you overdose on vitamin C? Okay. And the answer is, I suppose you can overdose on everything, but generally speaking, you cannot overdose on vitamin C. Because vitamin C dissolves in water, and what do all day long? You lose water, right? You urinate, and if you have an overdose of vitamin C, you just pass it out. You just void it with the urine if you have an overdose, unlike some other kinds of vitamins. So if you need to rebuild some part of your body, including bone, you should have a high diet of vitamin C so that you can make collagen easily. All right, so what does collagen do for bone? It gives bone flexibility and tensile strength. All right, it resists stretching, which is what we call tension, and it resists twisting, which we call torsion. So these are two forces that you should know about, tension and torsion. So collagen is what kind of substance? What does it kind of look like? Does it look like an ice cube or what? Yeah, it looks like a rod or a fiber. All right, so here I have an example of collagen right here. All right, so if we pull on two ends, right, collagen resists what? Stretching. What's that force called stretching? Tension. Now what about the force when we try to shrink something down? What do we call that? That is compression, right? So what about a fiber? Can a fiber resist tension, but what about compression? Can it resist compression? No, right? So bone, the collagen in bone, is really good for resisting tension, and because the way it's put in bone can resist twisting, we call it torsion, but can it resist tension? No. But your bones compression, right? It can't resist compression. So do bones resist compression, though? Yeah, because there's another component in bone. All right, so collagen, the organic part, resists tension. You have that on your notes. That's the organic part of bone. And the inorganic parts, namely the calcium, which gets incorporated with phosphate, that P is a phosphate molecule that makes calcium phosphate or hydroxyapatite. You see the formula right here. You don't have to remember the formulas. I just put it in the slide so you can kind of see how it's put together. All right, this is the compound that produces hardness and resists what? Compression forces. So you need both components in bone for it to work for you. You need the organic parts to resist tension. You need the inorganic parts to resist compression. If you're missing one or the other, right, your bones aren't going to behave. They're going to twist or bend or break, and there's different diseases associated with each of those conditions. Oh, I have a sign-in sheet. Did I pass a sign-in sheet around yet? Sign-in sheet is going around, and the card is going around. That's for the person that held the open lab. Sign it. Don't forget to give it back to me. All right, so organic and inorganic mixture together makes bone durable and strong without becoming brittle. Okay, and even concrete. Concrete is good. It resists compression, but not tension. But people add things to concrete to resist tension. What do we put in concrete to resist tension forces? We put metal rods. They call that rebar. Okay? So actually, when somebody knows something about anatomy or physiology, it can be applied to many different kinds of things, like architecture, for instance. There are many systems. Even air conditioning systems are modeled after how your body works. Okay. So what general and specific component of bone resists torsion? What resists torsion? Somebody said it. Collagen. What about compression? What resists compression? The calcium does, calcium phosphate, or you could say hydroxyapatite. And what resists tension? That's collagen, right? That's the collagen part in bone. All right. So let me go back to this right here. All right. So this is a different look at an osteon, and we can see what there are lamella, right? Concentric lamella here and here and here, tubes within tubes, And these stripes right here that kind of look like candy canes, that's the collagen fibers that are inserted into each of the lamella to resist tension and to resist torsion. And what can you tell me about the orientation between the different lamella of these collagen fibers right here? Are they all parallel? No. Okay, they cross each other over. And again, that gives a tremendous amount of strength to bone. Right? And has anybody ever seen where this kind of feature is used to make something very strong? Where there might be a natural line of weakness in the material. So not all the different layers in the material are collinear, but they're offset 90 degrees or at different angles to each other so that they can compensate for weakness. Where do we find that? Okay, for instance, like in plywood. I know probably many of you aren't builders, all right? Plywood, many sheets of wood. Wood has grain to it, but the grains aren't all lined up, right? They're put at different angles to each other. Tires, there's belts and tires. There's fibers and tires. And the different layers of the tires are offset with each other. All right, so again, just knowing how your body is put together can be applied to many different kinds of circumstances. All right, so we talked about the microscopic structure of bones, yeah. So here's a good question. What is the structural and functional unit of compact bone called?
Osteon.
It's that osteon, right. All right, so now let's talk about bone formation and growth a little bit. We got two different kinds, two major different kinds of bone growth or bone formation, and they are intramembranous ossification. Ossification just means what? When something turns to bone, right? And then you have endochondral ossification. That means when something else turns to bone. So in this case, intramembranous ossification, what is turning to bone? Okay. It's actually it's in the name. It's a membrane of some kind. So some kind of membrane is outlining where a bone should be after development. And so the membrane grows first, and then the osteoblasts move into that membrane and turn that membrane into bone. The other kind is endochondrial ossification. So what, in this case, it's not a membrane that models where the bone should be after development, but what is a model of where that bone is going to be? And again, it's in the word right here. It is, yeah, anytime you see chondrial or chondro, you should think of cartilage, right? So in this kind of ossification, the primordial bone is modeled out of cartilage, what it should look like, where it should be in your body, and then what kind of cell makes bone again? Oh yeah, the osteoblast makes bone, moves into the cartilage and turns that cartilage model of what the bone looks like into the actual bone. Okay, so those are the two main kinds, intramembranous and endochondrial. Let me see if I have a picture of some of these things. Pretty good. Okay, let's talk about, I don't have any pictures of intramembranous ossification. It's not as prevalent as endochondrial. Most bones are modeled out of cartilage first. All right, but most bones of the skull, and you're just starting to study skulls, I think, in lab, develop from intramembranous ossification because most bones in the skull are what? Very flat, all right? They're more like plates. So bones that are plate-like in nature usually originate from membranes. All right, so first, osteoblasts lay down a bone matrix within the membrane. And then the osteoblasts become osteocytes after they're completely surrounded by bone. And then they maintain the bone from there on out. The bones that form the skull are not completely formed at birth. And that's probably a really good thing. And there's big spaces between the flat bones of the skull. All right, so why is that very important for the infant not to have a completely formed skull before parturition? Yeah, because of the birth canal. I don't know what the maximum dilation of the cervix can be, but 5-6 centimeters maybe? I don't know how big somebody actually can dilate. So that head has to come out through the cervix, right? And one thing that promotes that is that the baby's head can squish, right? And the brain itself can squish pretty easily. So the bony plates of the skull can squish, fit through the birth canal, and then after through the birth canal, it can go back to its original location. Right, so there's fibrocartilage between the bony plates of the neonate's head, and those are what we call scientifically fontanelles. Right, and a fontanelle, since it's not made of bone, is very, very soft, and so the neonate's skull can be damaged very easily by trauma or vibration or shaking or any of that kind of thing. And I think probably you're all aware of that, and in lab you have to know some names of fontanelles of the skull, but maybe what you don't know from lab is how long does a fontanelle last for, okay, in a neonate? How long do you have to be really careful of fontanelles, okay? At least 2 years, right, before the neonate skull actually ossifies completely to completely cover those fontanelles up. All right, so fontanelles are important for both movement and growth. The brain grows very rapidly, so if the cranium were to ossify, I think the brain just would get squished in there. It would grow bigger than the skull can, and that would cause problems for that individual. A little story, a little side. There's a breed of dog who has fontanelles their whole life. Anybody know what kind of dog that is? Okay. And I think they're kind of cute. I don't have any of these at home. I have some big Dobermans at home. And I always thought it'd be really, really kind of fun to have the big Doberman with these little dogs running around until I learned that these little dogs have fontanelles their whole life. So this little dog played with this big Doberman. I'm just wondering if just by playing around, somebody would get punctured in the skull, and that would be the end of this really cute little dog. And that's a, does anybody know what cute little dog has fontanelles their whole life? There are chihuahuas that do, yeah. So if you have any chihuahuas, don't smack them around in the head. Okay, endochondrial ossification. This is how most bones develop. Oh, I tell you what. Yeah, so endochondrial ossification is how most bones develop, except where? In the head. And the other one that develops by intramembranous ossification is a clavicle, right, which is kind of strange. Your clavicle right here, right, is made out of intramembranous ossification. Those are the only ones. All the rest are by endochondrial, which means what? The bone is made out of cartilage first, and then it's converted to bone. All right, so a model of bone is made out of hyaline cartilage. Do you have a picture in your mind what hyaline cartilage looks like? Okay, and then the cartilage model ossifies in stages. All right, so I'll show you some pictures, I think, to describe this. What does it look like microscopically, though? All right, so here is cartilage. I can see some chondrocytes in here. And so this is the growing part of the bone right here. And then down over here, we have osteocytes actually producing bone. So if you look underneath a microscope, you're going to see both cartilage and bone in the same slide. You're not going to see anything that looks like a membrane, for instance, for endochondrial ossification. All right. So here is a typical, what kind of bone does that look like? Does that look like an irregular bone?
No.
Short bone? No. Long bone. That's right. That's a long bone right here. All right. So there's a primary ossification center in the diaphysis, and it forms a ring around the diaphysis. All right, so these cells are going to be very close to the periosteum. So this is where, and what kind of cells make bone again? I forgot. Osteocytes are found in mature bone. These are osteoblasts, right? So osteoblastic activity is going to cause the deposition of bone in what we call a bone collar around the diaphysis of this bone. So don't forget, this whole thing right here is what? This is all cartilage, right? This is all cartilage still. And it starts to form bone throughout the thickness of this bone right here. And then in the very center, we see that the bone and cartilage actually start to dissolve away. What's happening in this region right here? What kind of cell is working hard in this region right here? the osteoclast, right, is now making this medullary cavity. All right, so this is what we call the primary ossification center. So in a long bone, when I say primary ossification center, where would you focus somebody's attention? Okay, what do we call the middle? That is the, what do we call the middle? That's the medullary part of the bone is the deep part. But what part of a long bone is this right here? This is the diaphysis. Yeah, so the primary ossification center is in the diaphysis. And this ossification center is important for the growth of the bone in diameter. That's how bone grows in diameter. All right, but not in length. A bone grows in length from a secondary ossification center. So I see one here and here. So where do we see the secondary ossification centers? In the diaphyses, in both the proximal and distal Oh, I bet I said that wrong. I might have to rewind the tape. Okay, in the what? The epiphyses. In the proximal epiphysis and distal epiphysis. Right here, this is the secondary ossification center. So bone starts to be deposited here, and of course there has to be good blood supply, needs calcium and nutrients in order for that to happen. And these areas of ossification are hollowed out to make spongy bone or trabecular bone, just like the medullary components right here. So what cells are working right? There's two kinds of cells that are working right here. There's cells that are making bone, which are osteoblasts, and then there are cells that are making spongy bone. Those are the osteoclasts, right? All right, and then so that fills in the epiphysis here and up over here, and then you see the primary ossification center running into the secondary ossification center producing this line. All right, so I don't see any cartilage right here. I just see spongy bone. I don't see any cartilage up over here, but I do see cartilage in this area. Now, what did we call that area? That's the epiphyseal plate, right? And so this remains an active center for bone growth, right, until puberty. And it remains cartilage, which is what? Easily damaged. It's not very, very tough. So any kind of twisting or compression or tension on this long bone can easily damage this epiphyseal plate during development. And then this bone, right, will stop growing from this center, and maybe it will stop growing from this center as well. And if it's only on one side of your body, all right, maybe you damage a long bone on one side of your body, what's going to happen? Yeah, one bone is going to be a lot longer than the other, right? I don't know of any way to help that situation. Only after, as you're growing, of course, you can get a bigger shoe on one side of your body that has a bigger heel. All right, and then that will kind of even out. So it's real important when you have youngsters to kind of look at them and make sure that they're not doing something that's going to damage those epiphyseal plates. And there's a couple things that really do that the most, and that is like what I used to do, jump off a swing, okay, and land when you're swinging. But there's something else too. What is that twisting force called? The twisting motion is torsion, okay, with immature bone that's very damaging. And there's some youngsters, especially boys, when they play a certain game, put a lot of twisting motion on their dominant arm, okay, yeah, which is most people is their right arm, right? You have a dominant arm and a non-dominant arm usually. And when people learn how to play baseball and throw a baseball, that can damage somebody's arm. Not so much if you just throw straight. All right, so a lot of youngsters, when they want to be pitchers right before puberty, in Little League, they're told specifically never try to throw a ball that has a lot of spin on it. But those are the coolest ones to throw, right? Like curveballs, you have to put a lot of spin, or screwball. But when you do that, what do? To the bones of your arm? You twist them, and that can damage the epiphyseal plates. And somebody that wants to be an athlete, that's a terrible time to forever damage your bone structure as a result of that. So people in Little League are told that they can throw fastballs as hard as they want, which is okay because that's not twisting, but no screwballs, no curveballs, right, to protect their bones. And if they damage their arm, there's really nothing we can do about that. Okay. Huh?
But But even cut a piece of them.
Can we cut and do a replacement or something?
The
problem with doing any kind of procedure on somebody's body is when you do a procedure, you always have scar tissue. Okay? And so it's always a judgment call that a clinician has to make. You know, is surgery good or bad? When you do surgery, that might hurt as much as help something. Okay? So, I don't know of any surgical technique or stretching technique or anything. I know that there are some techniques maybe not offered in the United States that can work on bones, stretch bones out, but there's nothing that I know of scientifically proven that can help anybody. Okay. All right, so that's that epiphyseal plate. And then I think, did I tell you last time, at least within a family, who's taller? Is it the men or the women?
Men.
Okay, and why is that? It relates to this epiphyseal plate right here. Because when does this epiphyseal plate ossify? It turns from cartilage to bone, and when it turns to bone, that bone will no longer grow in a long direction. It can grow in diameter, but not in length anymore. When does that epiphyseal plate ossify? Right at puberty. And typically in a family, who reaches maturity sooner, men or women? Yeah, the women do. And so they stop growing at an earlier age. Men continue to grow for another 20 years or so, and so they're typically taller. I'm just kidding. It's not 20 years. How come nobody laughed at that? Okay, another year or two. Okay. All right, so that's pretty much everything. Appositional growth, that's growth of bone by addition of bone to one surface while it's subtracted from the opposite surface. So that's how a bone grows, what, in diameter. Bone is deposited on the cortical surface by the periosteum, and bone is resorbed within the medulla of the bone via the membrane. What's a membrane on the inside of a bone called? The endosteum. So osteoclastic activity is mostly found in the endosteum, and osteoblastic activity is usually found in the periosteum on the outside of a bone. All right, so bone remodeling. Last couple of things that we're going to talk about. When you break a bone, okay, of course it's going to hemorrhage, and you got to be really concerned about that hemorrhage, especially if it's a big bone. But one of the nice things, because bone has a large vascular supply, it can heal very rapidly. Unlike tendons and ligaments, tendons and ligaments don't have a blood supply, and they might not ever heal, as a matter of fact. All right, once they're stretched out, for instance, or ripped. Bones, on the other hand, do a marvelous job of repairing themselves because they're highly vascular. So what's the process? Think of it as like remodeling your house. Before you remodel your house, what do you have to do? You might have to knock some walls down, break things apart, right? So, but in this particular case, since the bone is broken already, your body needs to get rid of those sharp fragments of bones, because they could lacerate blood vessels or nerves, right? And that nerve might not ever regenerate itself, and you'll have a motor or sensory deficit. So there are cells that break those fragments down. What are those cells that break those sharp fragments of bone down? Those are the osteoclasts. Get rid of all those nasty fragments, all right? And then osteoblasts move in and begin to deposit new bone matrix, and that process takes about 4 to 6 weeks for that to happen. So a little bit more specifically, what is happening there? Well, when bone is broken, there has to be a blood clot that forms, a blood clot. So you have that connective tissue surrounding the break, and blood, when it leaks out of a blood vessel, forms a solid. That's what we call a clot. And that clot is made out of, you don't have to know the name of that compound, but it's called fibrin. All right? It's not quite as strong as collagen, but fibrin forms that clot. And so it's stabilized. After about 2 to 3 days, a callus is formed. A callus is made out of a weak matrix of collagen, again, just to stabilize the fragments and to stabilize any blood vessels that are broken. And then the callus fills in with more collagen and even some cartilage, and that stabilizes the bone fragments together. All right, so that this is where now When you have a broken bone, typically, how do you like to treat it? Well, it's one of the things that if I look around the room and if I see one of these things, I kind of automatically know somebody has a broken bone. A cast, right? Because a callus is not very strong, right? So after about 4 or 5 days, for sure after about a week, when that callus is formed, you don't ever want to damage that callus because it's not very strong. So if a callus is damaged after it's formed, the bone might not ever grow back better or the way it should. And so we immobilize that fracture with a cast. So it protects what? What is a cast protecting? It's protecting that callus, right, that's holding the bones together. Okay, and then osteoblasts enter the callus and deposit new bone matrix so that in about 4 or 6 weeks or so, then you have a nice strong bone that's completely ossified, and it's probably even stronger than it was originally. That's really nice. Now, some people might have to wear casts for a little bit longer period of time because it's in a part of their body that they have to use. Has anybody broken a toe, like a big toe in here? We take our big toes for granted, right? And as soon as you break one, all right, this is what a physician's going to tell you. You need bed rest for 6 weeks. Who can stay in bed for 6 weeks? You can? That's wonderful, okay? But usually you can't. Okay, well, this semester I know you can't. Maybe next semester, but you just can't stay in bed. So what are you doing with that toe? You're using it all the time, right? You can try to mobilize, or a leg, for instance. Again, you can try to mobilize a leg, but you have to use that part of your body to have any kind of normal life. So if you're using a bone that's broken, it's going to take longer to heal, but you got to be careful with it, right? So somebody might be in a cast for longer than 6 weeks if it's a bone that you can't give rest to during that healing process. All right, so that's kind of it for bone. What are the two main ways that bone is made? Two different models. Wait, to think of it, two different models. Two different models for making bone. It is intramembranous or endochondrial ossification. Yeah, intramembranous or endochondrial ossification. All right, so let's not forget, where's that sign, where's the card at? Right here. And the sign-in sheet? We got that too? All right. So does anybody have any questions before we go on to the next chapter? Yeah. Okay, hold it down a little bit so I can hear the question. Yeah? Yeah. Yeah. So for instance, a good way to think of an appositional growth, where does a bone grow in diameter from? The epiphyses or the diaphysis? Diaphysis. Okay. How many membranes are associated with that diaphysis? There's two. Which is, and where are they? Outside, what do we call that one on the outside? The periosteum. And the one, where's the other one? On the inside, what do we call the one on the inside? Endosteum. Endosteum. Okay. One is responsible for building bone primarily, and the other is primarily responsible for breaking it down. Which one is primarily responsible for breaking it down? Okay, that's the cell, but I'm talking about the membrane. What membrane? The endosteum, the one in the middle, because the whole, the medullary cavity has to be hollowed out as a bone grows. And so the endosteum is where we find a lot of osteoclastic activity. All right, what membrane is responsible for building bone primarily? That's the periosteum. So it has primarily osteoblasts, the kind of cell that builds bone up. So when a bone is growing in diameter, it's dissolving bone on the inside because of the endosteum, but it is depositing bone on the cortical surface because of the osteoblasts. That's oppositional growth.
And compact bone versus spongy bone?
Yeah.
Is it the same activity?
Same activity, yeah. Oh, you know, I forgot to mention something. Did I answer your question? Okay. Yeah. Before I have to change topics. Okay, so here you have, you got those two cells. Here is the blast, and here is a clast, right here. And what happens if So these are working in two different methods. This is building bone, this is breaking bone down. If there's nice, perfect balance between them, then you have a nice, healthy bone. Right? But if your bones are starting to dissolve away, guess which one is working harder? The clasts are working harder than the blast right here. It might not mean that the blasts are not working at all. It just means that these over here are working too hard. So then you start to lose bone as a result of that. So there's a little bit of an imbalance. And there's a very interesting kind of disease process, at least from my standpoint. And that is, all right, diseases in general, for instance, if there is a cold going around, like if, does anybody have a cold in here? Probably somebody does. All right, does that mean we're all going to catch that cold? No, it's impossible, right? Because why? We're a very diverse population, all right? So no matter what the disease process is, it's just extremely rare for everybody in the population to come down with that disease process. But I know one disease process in here that's going to affect every woman if you're lucky enough to live long enough. And that is really strange that something is going to affect everybody. What disease, can you read my mind? What is that? That is osteoporosis. That means that it's going to affect your what? Osteo means bones, right? So it's a disease process affecting bones. Okay? So all women, if you're lucky enough to live long enough, these cells, the osteoclast, will have a little bit more activity than the osteoblast. So osteoporosis means what? A little loss of bone matrix, right? And this especially happens after menopause, postmenopausal women. We think it has to do with estrogen levels, okay? And what does that look like? I think I have a picture of it. It's almost a good picture. I'll describe why maybe it's not a fantastic picture, but a pretty good picture. Okay. Here's a picture. The top picture is pretty much a normal bone. Now, does this look like compact bone or spongy bone?
Spongy bone.
Yeah, that's spongy bone. And then down over here, we see a scanning electron micrograph of what osteoporosis looks like in somebody. And can you see that these trabeculae here are nice and strong, but what about the trabeculae over here in osteoporosis? Oh, they're all hollowed out. They have all these pits in them. So this is a very weak kind of bone structure. And this person is missing, what, that hydroxyapatite, and that makes for a very brittle kind of bone. All right, so all women, and as a matter of fact, even men, as we get older, our bones will get more brittle. But men are protected from osteoporosis for a reason. Why are men protected from osteoporosis compared to women? I tell you what. Put your arm out. Who's got bigger bones? Yeah. Typically men have bigger bones, so when they start to lose calcium, they can afford to lose a lot more before it becomes a clinical problem. Okay? It's just because women have smaller bones are more susceptible to osteoporosis. But everybody will lose calcium as we get older. All right? So how do you protect yourself from that? All right? If you know that your muscles are going to degenerate and get small as you get older, what can you do now? You can exercise. You can build that muscle up. You can get it to grow, right, and respond to some kind of stress. And what about bones? What did I say about bones? The same thing, right? Exercise. If you exercise a bone, it will get bigger and stronger, right? So all women can protect themselves to a large degree from osteoporosis with exercise. But what else do you need in order to make a strong bone? You need calcium in your diet. So as you're going to see in a lot of physiology classes and anatomy, the way to protect yourself from disease is exercise and diet, the proper exercise and diet, and osteoporosis is just another one of these disease processes. And people really hate to take my anatomy and physiology classes because they learn how do you fight disease processes that will happen in you? Diet and exercise, which is like the last things that we really want to do. Okay? So don't forget, when you stress the bone, exercise the bone, it gets bigger and stronger, and it protects you from osteoporosis, especially though premenopausally. It works okay sort of postmenopausally, but especially premenopausally. It also says that some women are more susceptible to osteoporosis than others. Okay? Why are some women more susceptible to osteoporosis? Yeah, for instance, just like the reason why men aren't so susceptible. If you're a woman and you're blessed with big, strong bone structure, you're going to be less susceptible to osteoporosis, right? But if you're a woman with a very dainty skeletal structure, you're going to be more susceptible to it just because of the stronger your bones are, the more you can afford to lose bone postmenopausally, right? Okay. So osteoporosis is important to know about. This picture is okay, but you know what? It's not really good because the magnification of these two gives you the impression that the magnification is the same, but actually this one here, the magnification is a lot less. So these holes, this hole right here, would be like covering this whole picture right here. Right? So these, the holes that you see with osteoporosis are very large. So this picture is a little bit misleading. The bone is even worse off than you would normally imagine. All right, so that's the last part about bones. So let's go to the next chapter, which you guys already are starting in lab. So what is that? Oh, that's not this one. We covered this one already. Okay. That's this. And I need to go back up, right up over here. Okay. So now we're going to actually start talking about some bones and themselves, some of the gross anatomical features of bones, and not so much about processes of bones or the functions of bones or what's happening with bones. And when you start to look at the skeleton, you see a lot of bones. So let's categorize some bones first. So all the bones in your body can be grouped into two parts, two different locations. Does anybody know what the two different locations in your body are? It's the one kind of skeleton versus another kind of skeleton. Yeah. Yeah. So when you think of a bone, try to think of what part of the skeleton it contributes to. Is it the axial skeleton or the appendicular skeleton? All right, so the appendicular skeleton has to do with what? Your appendages, your arms and legs, and some bones that attach your arms and legs to your body. That's the appendicular skeleton. The other skeleton is your axial skeleton, which it holds your appendages. So on this picture right here, you can see the two different colors of the bones, axial versus appendicular. Okay. So the white ones right here, these are the bones that make up the axial skeleton, so bones of the head, all right, the neck and the thorax, the vertebral column, make up the axial skeleton. And these yellow bones right here are bones that make up the appendicular skeleton. Right, so your upper appendage and your lower appendage plus bones that hold your lower appendage to the axial skeleton like the ascoxae and bones that hold your upper appendage to your axial skeleton, those would be the clavicle and the scapula. Right, so the clavicle, scapula, and the ascoxae, those are appendicular bones as well. They're not really axial bones. So this is a good place to start in knowing all the bones. Right, you're going to have to know a lot more about bones than just their name, but this is a good place to start. I don't know if this is an exam figure. It might be an exam figure. You might want to start practicing these right away. Right, that's going to help you on the practicum as well. Okay. All right, so now before we start talking about bones, let's talk about some terminology for bones. All right, so you might have a bone, and it might have a spot on it that is raised and it's rough and it's a kind of a big bony bulge right there. So why is this bone growing bigger in one location compared to another location? It's responding to something. What is it responding to? Why would a bone or a part of a bone get bigger in some location? What is it experiencing in its daily life? It's experiencing some kind of stress. Maybe something's pulling on it in that location, right? So So if a bone is being stressed, the bone is going to respond by getting bigger and stronger in that location. So for instance, when a muscle is attached to a bone via tendon, that tendon is pulling on the bone, in that area, it's going to get bigger and stronger, right? And it's just not going to be a smooth, flat surface. All right, so a raised, rough spot on a bone is almost always used as a muscle attachment, right? A muscle attachment. So a muscle-bone connection is what we call a tendon, and a bone-to-bone connection is a ligament. So again, if you have muscles pulling on different bones and they're stabilized by ligament attachments, where the ligament attaches, it's going to hypertrophy, it's going to get bigger to handle that stress. So all of these raised rough areas on a bone are what we call a process. So process doesn't mean function, it really means structure in this case. Right? It means what? A raised rough area on the surface of the bone. So here are some names of processes that when you study bones you'll be familiar with where these are. A tubercle, a tuberosity. Trochanter is a very large process. An epicondyle, depending on the bone, these can be large processes. And who can pronounce this one right here? Yeah, that's a malleolus. Malleolus, those make your ankles, your ankle bones kind of stick out laterally. All right, that's where the medial and lateral malleoli are. There can be a crest on a bone. So a crest is a more long and narrow raised part of a bone. All right, and a line is a not quite so large, long, elongated, raised area on a bone. And a spine is what? What is a spine? You want to get poked with a spine? No, a spine is what? Long and narrow. All right, so a long and narrow part of a bone sticking away from the major part of the bone. What's a spine good for? What's a spine? What is a spine good for? What is a crest on a bone good for? Okay. As a matter of fact, anytime somebody asks you, all right, what's the function of a process without thinking, you should say, what? Muscle attachment. All right? Muscle attachment. Just say muscle attachment. Or maybe you could just even abbreviate it, MA. So what's the function of a spine on a bone? Not everybody got 100% on that quiz. What's the function of a spine on a bone? Muscle attachment. Just say muscle attachment. What about a crest? Muscle attachment. What about a tuberosity? Muscle attachment. What's the function of a tubercle? Muscle attachment. Right. Okay. So that's all there's to that. Okay. There's another feature that some bones have, and that is a depression. And it's going to maybe look like a bowl. Some of these bowls are pretty extensive. Others are kind of just short little depressions, small depressions in a bone. And these sometimes we call a fossa, F-O-S-S-A. If it's a longer kind of depression, we're going to call it a sulcus. And another name for a sulcus could be a groove. That's a more elongated depression in a bone. And if it is more spherical, we're going to call it an alveolus. So if it looks like a grape or a berry, spherical in nature, that's an alveolus. All right? And all these depressions are in bones for what particular purpose? Holding something. Yeah, why do you have a bowl at home? It's going to hold something that you put in it. Right? So again, if somebody asks you, what's the function of this sulcus right here, you're going to say it's for... It's holding something. And then if somebody's a real smart aleck, they'll ask you in anatomy, oh, what's it holding? Okay, but when we study bones, you won't have to know that. But later on, we'll fill in some of those details. Okay. All right, a hole in a bone is a passageway for something. And holes in a bone run around with different names depending on their structure a little bit. But a lot of cases, we call it a foramen. A foramen is a hole. Now, don't ask me where that came from, but that's what we call a hole in a bone. Another hole in a bone can be called a meatus. There's one place that's a really big hole in a bone. It's really long and big. And if there's a hole in a bone that's very elongated, then we call that a canal. instead of just a very short hole in a bone. If it's a very deep hole, we're going to call it a fissure. And as a matter of fact, some bones have big holes on the inside, right? We call that a cavity. And another name for a cavity is a sinus. And you're kind of familiar with a sinus already. For instance, when you have a cold, what gets plugged up? Your sinuses, right? And we have what we call paranasal sinuses in some bones of our facial bones. And they get inflamed, they get filled up with fluid and things like that. And so then you say, well, I have a sinus cold. A sinus is a cavity in some bones. Did you guys know what bones have paranasal sinuses in them yet in lab? Probably not. But there's this really big bone in the front of your face right here. What do we call that one? Frontal bone. See, anatomy isn't always hard. The big bone in the front, that's the frontal bone. That has a big sinus cavity, paranasal sinus cavity. Guess what the name of that sinus cavity is in your frontal bone? That's called the frontal sinus, right? So a lot of times anatomy is really simple, okay? There's another bone, your cheekbone right here. That's the maxilla. And there's a sinus in the maxilla too. Guess what we call it? Maxillary sinus. So a lot of times in anatomy, things actually make sense. Okay, so a hole. What is a hole in a bone used for? What's the function of a foramen? Yeah, it's a passageway for something. Maybe a blood vessel has to go through the bone. All right, so that's a passageway. A meatus, what's the function of a meatus? It's a passageway. Yeah, and a fissure, what's the function of a fissure? It's a passageway as well, right. Okay. Another feature of bones is that some bones will have a smooth surface on them. If you feel a process with your fingertips, it's going to be raised, and it's going to be a bump, and it's going to be very rough. It's going to be a rough surface. So even with your eyes closed, you can tell what a process is because it's rough. But these others right here that I'm talking about, all right, are going to be smooth. If you palpate them with your fingertips, you're going to feel that it's a very smooth surface. It might be a depression or it might be a raised surface, but in every case, it's going to be very smooth. So even in anatomy lab, maybe close your eyes a couple times and just feel what these bones feel like. All right? And smooth surfaces are going to form joints between bones because the bones are going to be moving. Would you want to have rough surfaces moving against each other? What would happen? If it's like sandpaper rubbing on the wall, what's going to happen to the wall? It's going to get ground away, right? But if they're two smooth surfaces touching each other, what's going to happen? Well, they're just going to slip and slide over each other. They're not going to grind each other away. If bones are grinding each other away, what do we call that? That's a pathological condition. We call that, called arthritis. That's arthritis, when bones actually grind themselves away because those smooth surfaces are gone. So when you see this term articulation, you should think of a joint, right? So an articulating surface is a joint surface, right? It's a smooth surface. Some joint surfaces we call condyles. That's a smooth surface. A head on a bone is going to be smooth for what kind of function? What's the function of a head on a bone? It's going to be for an articulation. A facet, that's a depression. It's for holding a neighboring bone, but in this particular case, it also means that it's going to form a joint, right? An articulation. What's the function of the capitulum? What's the function of the capitulum? Articulation. What's the function of the trochlea? Articulation. These are all rough, smooth surfaces on a bone for articulation. And we're going to learn where the trochlea and capitulum is. They're in your elbow. Okay? And your elbow is a really neat joint because it can act as a hinge, but you can also rotate like this at your elbow. So it has some interesting features. Did we learn? Maybe for the first test. What is this motion called? I think we learned motions for the first test. We didn't? Oh, okay, never mind. Okay. We'll learn that. Maybe in this chapter we learn it. All right, one last structural feature. If we have a bone, okay, for instance, I'm such a really good artist, okay? And here we have some teeth here. We got some teeth here. Okay, what is this thing? This is your jawbone. Anybody know what the jawbone is called yet? That's the mandible. All right, and you can see the mandible has this big angulation in it. This is what we call a ramus. All right, so this is the ramus because this is the major part. This is the body of the mandible. It makes a 90-degree bend, and here is the ramus. We're going to see some other bones that have this 90-degree bend to them, and that's always going to be a ramus. Okay, so that's what a ramus is. All right, so guess where we're going to start next time? Now we know some. So look over this terminology. Oh, next time we got a test, don't forget. Okay. But a week from today, we're going to start by looking at some of these bones of the skull. Okay? All right, so don't forget about SI. And the sign-in sheet is down here. And if you want to open lab and want to say thanks to the instructor, the card is here.